Thanks for joining us for the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast. We are excited to have Richard Harris as the guest for today's episode. Richard Harris has been a science correspondent at the National Public Radio since 1986. He took a break from that to write Rigor Mortis, a book about rigor and reproducibility in biomedical research, which was published in 2017. Rigor Mortis was a finalist for the 2018 National Academies Communication Award. In this podcast episode, we're talking to Richard about his experience as a science writer, the Rigor Mortis book, and Minor Tweak Major Impact stories that it covers, and we're discussing other topics such as the impact of the coronavirus pandemic and more. So let's jump right in. Richard, I would like to welcome you to the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Richard, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you're currently working on?
Yes, I am a science journalist. I have been for my entire career. I have an undergraduate degree in biology, which I got from University of California at Santa Cruz. And I've decided to be a science reporter, and I never look back. And I've been at NPR since 1986, covering science and medicine and the environment. And right now, like most of the science writers around the world, I am covering the COVID pandemic. So I'm spending almost all of my time dealing with that. And it's obviously an incredibly important story, and it brings to bear a lot of the technical background and my experience in reading journal papers, et cetera, that I have honed over the past 35 years.
How and when did you get interested in science writing?
I loved biology as an undergraduate, but the end of my undergraduate year came about. I thought, you know, I don't really want to specialize in anything. And I had by then dabbled a little bit in science writing and discovered, wow, this is a cool way to be able to look at everything in the universe that interests me. And I do mean universe because I was interested in physics. I've done ocean science stories. I've done geology stories. I've done astronomy stories. You know, you name it, biology stories. I've had a taste of them. And it's a wonderful opportunity to sort of have a career in continuing education. So I decided that would be my trajectory.
That's very cool. And the reason really why I reached out to you is you're the author of a book called Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. And that book, it got published, I think, in 2017. And we already, on this podcast, we had a couple of the people that you interviewed for that book. We had them on the show here. But can you please tell us a little bit more about that book and really how, when, and why really you had the idea and motivation to write it?
Right. In 2014, NPR decided to shuffle some of the science desk beats around a little bit. And they asked me if I would mind returning to covering biomedical research. And I had done that on and off over the years. I covered the sequencing of the human genome towards the end of the 90s and into the early 2000s. And I thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. I had been doing a lot of climate change research reporting for the previous decade, but I thought, okay, I'm ready for a change of pace. So when I took off on that new beat, I decided the first thing I wanted to do is understand the lay of the land, since I hadn't been paying that much attention for 10 years. And the first thing I discovered was that funding for biomedical research in academia in this country had dropped by about 20% in terms of spending power over the previous decade. And I thought, that can't be good. People are having to fight harder and harder to get a diminishing resource of funds, and that must not be doing great things for science. The other thing I discovered was a couple of scattered studies about reproducibility in biomedicine. And I thought, maybe those two things are connected. They must be connected somehow. And so after about a year of sort of figuring out what was going on and doing actually some stories related to this at NPR, I decided to take a sabbatical and write my first book. And so that's what I did.
That's very cool. And what was it like to work on the book? And also, I was wondering, how did you find the people to interview for the book? And what are some things that you learned along the way?
Well, I really enjoyed stepping back from daily journalism. I'd been doing it at NPR for almost 30 years at that point, and stepping away from a daily deadline to a deadline that was, you know, a year plus away seemed like an incredible luxury. And what I basically did was I just started following the literature, and I just reported it the way I would report a news story, except I had all the time that I wanted to devote to it. I found people who wrote about stuff in publications. I would chase them down and talk to them, and they would talk to me about other people who were doing interesting things, and I just basically explored the literature and sort of the network of people who are concerned about these issues. So I think the biggest surprise for me around that was I sort of was a little bit wondering whether scientists would really want to talk to me about this at all, because it sort of feels like they might regard this as sort of airing their dirty laundry. But it was amazing to me how many people were actually very interested interested in talking to me and felt passionate about this issue. A lot of people recognize that this is a significant issue in biomedical research, and they wanted to get the word out there, and they felt that this was a reasonable way to do it. I must say, I'd never encountered anyone who thought that they were the person doing irreproducible science. It was always somebody down the hall who was, you wouldn't believe what they're up to. But the reality was, people are concerned about this issue, and I lent a sympathetic ear and told their stories.
And so the book, it's really full of minor tweak, major impact moments, stories, such as the method all of a sudden stops working, or maybe something works in the hand of one person, but not in the hand of another person, or all of a sudden there's these really little tweaks that just cause methods to just stop working. And already, as I mentioned earlier, we did hear some of the stories from your book in previous episodes of this podcast, but what were some of the most eye-opening and interesting minor tweak, major impact moments that you learned about by interviewing the researchers for the book?
One thing that I hadn't realized the breadth of it was the problems with using antibodies. And these are, of course, incredibly common research tools, but they often produce results that are not as advertised. And I think one of the biggest surprises for me was talking to one of the major manufacturers of monoclonal antibodies, and they were just starting to go through their catalog to try to understand whether their antibodies actually perform as they expected they would. And this is the early days of applying CRISPR to this problem. And what they were doing was they would take a protein target and they would CRISPR it out of whatever they were looking at. And it was surprising how often the antibodies would still show a positive result when it actually clearly shouldn't if they've removed a key part of the protein that they were supposedly detecting with their antibodies. So I think this is a minor tweak, major concern for the companies and should be for scientists as well. Obviously, there are ways to work around this. If you're aware that this is a potential, you can do very careful controls and so on. But the reality is scientists tend to think, well, if I spent a lot of money on this antibody, it's going to work like it says on the package, and I won't even think twice about it. And I think that was one really eye-opening example that I came across.
And are there any stories that you found that did not make it into the book?
I actually don't remember. I don't think this made it in the book, but I'm not positive. But there was a story about some work at the University of Colorado at Boulder that had been working periodically, but not reliably. And the scientists finally realized what was happening, apparently, was there was something in the water that was a seasonal change in the water. And when the water was coming in the spring or whatever, they could get their good results from their experiments, but it was coming in the winter, they couldn't. I don't believe they ever published that, so I probably didn't put it in the book for that reason, but it was quite the anecdote to realize, wow, just something as minor as, you know, a change in whatever water is running off the Rocky Mountains from one season to another can actually completely change the results of an experiment. That was a nice example of a minor tweak and a major effect.
Yeah, that's crazy. What was your favorite story from all the stories that you heard?
I don't think I have a favorite. I mean, every story told a different part of the puzzle, right? And I think part of what interested me was actually just learning how people are trying to come to terms with this and understand how to fix it. Because nobody wants to wake up in the morning and do bad science, as one of the scientists said to me at one point in the interview. But the reality is, it's not altogether clear what is needed to fix things. But what's really heartening to me is to see how many people recognize that this is something that needs to get fixed, and people are focusing their attention, clearly a small minority, but there's a hardcore group of people who say, wow, we have to deal with this, we have to figure it out, and they're actively taking it on. And I think those notes of hope, I think, were really important to me as I was reporting the book, to see that, you know, people are not only acknowledging this as a problem, but thinking about, you know, there are ways we can solve this, and we need to take more attention to do that.
Right. And then I was wondering, so now it has been about 3 years since the book got published, and I know 3 years in the science world, it's not a long time, but did you see anything change in the past 3 years, or is there anything that you noticed that changed in the science community since then?
Oh, I think a lot has changed. I think scientists in biomedicine have really embraced this and recognized this is a significant issue. Maybe 3 years ago, they were starting to. I think that's a very strong sense right now. The National Academy of Sciences has actually come out with a report last year looking more broadly in science, not just at biomedicine, but in reproducibility and other areas of science as well. So institutions are taking notice and thinking about it. And clearly, a lot of these changes take time, and the wheels were turning before my book was published, and these actions have happened since. But I mean, just really trying to think about better procedures, thinking about how to change the educational system so that biomedical scientists get more training in experimental design and so on, and how they can have more awareness around these issues. Because it's not just sloppiness, despite the subtitle that my publisher insisted on putting on the cover of the book, but it is, in fact, the incentive system within science is broken. And scientists are encouraged to publish really flashy ideas. And it doesn't matter so much if they're right or wrong. The point is that they have a lot of zing and they get published in a big name journal. And that's how people build careers. And people are thinking about how do we change the reward system in science so that it's not just about the zing, but it's about actually having results that mean things to people. And one thing I've seen in the coronavirus pandemic situation is so many scientists have just turned their attention to coronavirus. They may or may not have grants around this, and they may not be in their sweet spot of research, but tons and tons of biomedical scientists have said, you know, this is such an important issue. How can I take on a small piece of this from what I know, from my skill set? And it's amazing to see how much of that's going on. And I think that that's partly, I think, a reflection of this willingness and this desire to get results that actually mean something, that aren't just, you know, career enhancing, but that actually benefit society. I also think probably on the flip side of that, my supposition is there are going to be a lot of papers published. I think there already have been a lot of preprints published that are irreproducible, that are results that are deeply flawed. So I think it's really good that scientists are also focused on issues of reproducibility and bear that in mind when they sit down and open a paper instead of just saying, oh, what have we found now? It's like, well, where could this be wrong? And I think that skepticism is always healthy in science. And I think it's enhanced a bit as people recognize how much of biomedical research really is on shaky ground.
Right, that's very interesting. So you mentioned one thing is that we really do have to do something to change the reward system. And do you have any ideas of like how we can address this or what are the things that we can change in the way that a scientist does get rewarded for their work?
Right. I think one thing, they're all challenging answers and they are all interlocking. So you can't just do one thing. You have to sort of work with all of the system as a whole to make this work. But I think one simple thing that some deans are starting to think about and hiring committees and chair people of departments and so on, they're coming to recognize that they should not be using sort of the simple filter of how many papers does this person have published in Science, Nature, and Cell, and trying to ask more deeply about what the impact of that individual's work has been when thinking about hiring and promoting. I mean, it's unfortunately become a shortcut for people who are overwhelmed with job applicants or who have a lot of scientists who have many, many papers that basically they figure I'll sort of offload this evaluation to journal editors. And if they think this person has done some really interesting work that's worthy of being published in Nature, for heaven's sakes, they must be good scientists. But that's not necessarily true at all. I do have a story from the book about Brian Nosek, who's a professor of psychology and also runs an institution outside of the University of Virginia that deals with these issues. And one thing he said was when he was up for tenure, they said, you know, print out all your papers. They said, what are you talking about? I have like 200 papers or something like that. You're not going to read 200 papers. What are you going to do? Weigh them? They said, print out your papers. That's how we do tenure around here. So he did. And he was sure that nobody read them. He did get tenure though. But he said that if his university instead said when he came there, when you're up for tenure, we are going to ask you to give us your 10 most meaningful papers. He says, I would have actually crafted my research project quite differently because I would say, I want to get 10 really interesting papers as opposed to dozens and dozens of papers that are kind of like little nibble here, a little nibble there. And he says that it would have actually been more salutary for his research career to do something like that as opposed to just sort of thinking about volume of output. So I think academic institutions have a very important role in doing that. I think another thing that's happened to a small extent is the NIH is trying to look more broadly beyond these highly competitive grant proposals and trying to identify people who have maybe really interesting ideas, but don't necessarily make it through the sort of traditional gauntlet of getting a grant approval. The NIH does have a certain number of grants that they can sort of institutionally grant on their own. And they've been playing around with the idea of rewarding a certain number of individuals as opposed to specific ideas. This is the Howard Hughes Medical Institute model, where you basically pick people you think are hot scientists and you say, here, take a pile of money. We don't care what you do. We just believe in you. And the NIH has been playing with that concept as well. So I think that's another thing that can also help get people away from this super high pressure culture that pushes people in directions they don't really want to be pushed in.
Right. That's very interesting. Yeah, I think funders can play a big role in this. And I do see more and more funders are understanding this and they're moving into like a right direction for this to motivate scientists to focus more on the work rather than having large volume of just like things that might not mean much. Based on all the other experience and knowledge about research and researchers in general, what do you think researchers can really change in their work itself to improve science and make it more rigorous and reproducible?
That's not an area of my expertise in particular, but I certainly would say to think about things like asking the right questions about sample size. A lot of people learn about that by just sort of what is the tradition in the laboratory, how many animals you should use, for example. And I think the answer is sometimes those tradition-based approaches really are not good science, but people just learn from their environment and people have to start asking these harder questions. It's like, well, how do you figure out what is the right sample size? And there clearly are methods for doing that. And a lot of scientists do it, but a lot of preclinical biomedical researchers don't necessarily do that. Or they think about it, but they realize, oh, I can't afford that many mice, so I'm going to do, one-tenth as many. I'll call it a pilot study, and I'll cross my fingers that the results actually would hold up if I had done it with a full number of mice or what have you. So I think just thinking more carefully about experimental design. One of the people I interviewed in my book is Arturo Casadevall, who's at Johns Hopkins, who incidentally is deeply involved in an experiment right now involving convalescent plasma from people who've recovered from COVID-19, and they are donating their blood plasma and using it as either a treatment or exploring it as a preventive for COVID-19. So speaking of someone who turned on a dime when COVID-19 came around, and he's been very much concerned about medical education, and he's been trying to figure out how do you teach scientists to think more deeply about the science they're doing. Instead of just performing another experiment, taking time to sit down and think about what it means and what the result could be and what's going on. And sort of the way he put it to me was he wants to put the philosophy back in the PhD in teaching young scientists how to think about and how to approach science. And I think the NIH has funded a number of initiatives to try to explore different and better ways of doing science education in this group of, I guess, largely graduate students in the biomedical sciences and trying to get people to think more systematically and more broadly about the basics like experimental design.
Right. So you mentioned that due to the coronavirus pandemic, a lot of researchers, they have really been shifting whatever they were working on to work on coronavirus. What do you see that the coronavirus pandemic is doing really to the scientific community? Do you think that the whole COVID-19 pandemic has any impact on the scientific community as a whole?
Well, I think many, many people are looking to scientists for salvation, for the answer, for it to be rescued from the coronavirus. And I think this scientists do have the potential to provide that. I think it's an important lesson for people who take science for granted that it actually has such important potential benefits to human beings that we shouldn't take it for granted. We should think about it. I also think that there are layers upon layers of this because obviously science has been highly politicized in this country. And some people reject these ideas or they push crazy ideas of hydroxychloroquine as a treatment or prevention for COVID-19, and just so much dismissal of scientists and scientific ideas and science-based ideas because people bring their own philosophy to it and they don't necessarily believe that it really matters if they wear a mask or they don't care or they have different values that it's more important for them to do what they feel like doing as opposed to doing what pointy-headed scientists have to say. But I actually think that scientists can play a critical role here. We do have to be very cautious and wide-eyed about the possibility that politics will try to interfere with science. We've seen some examples of that already. The greatest concern, I think, is around a vaccine. There's such a push to get it done before Election Day. People are very concerned that that means that the whole process would be politicized and that we shouldn't believe what the outcome will be. On the other hand, people like Dr. Anthony Fauci at the NIH, every opportunity he gets, he says, I promise I'm not going to be pushed around by the winds of politics. We're only going to do this if it actually works in terms of science. So I predict a pretty challenging moment when they come up with a vaccine that they assert will work and whether people will believe them or not.
Right. It's going to be very interesting. And then my last question, and this is kind of like, usually we have like a just a fun question at the end of the interview. And usually I ask if they were allowed to make a wish for a tool that would help them to make their life easier in a lab, what would that be? But because I know you're not in a lab, I will ask it a little different. But if there was just a tool or a concept or a change in the system that could really help the scientific world to be better as a whole, what would that be? And this is our fun question, and any answers are allowed.
I have not really thought about this, but obviously if you could convince people that scientific method has real meaning behind it, it's not just another philosophy, but it actually is a method that provides answers that approach the truth. If people believe that, then maybe they would understand more broadly why they should trust the results that are coming out of scientific labs. I think it's a critical time right now for people to believe that. It's also a critical time for us to also make sure that all of the methods have been followed and that they're not running shortcuts to get to answers that they want to arrive at. I mean, that's a pretty big magic wand, I guess I want to wave, to have people understand the scientific method and trust it. But if I could only do one thing, that wouldn't be a bad thing, don't you think?
I agree. That's awesome. Richard, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your stories and insights on the Minor Tweak Major Impact podcast.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is your host, Anita, and we look forward to being with you for our next episode.
This program was produced by H Media. We'll see you soon.